big color, bigger savings. Sherwin-Williams Super Sale is here. Get 40% off paints and stains April 24th through the 27th with prices starting at $30.89. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
What Came Next is intended for mature audiences only. Episodes discuss topics that can be triggering, such as emotional, physical, and sexual violence, animal abuse, suicide, and murder. I am not a therapist, nor am I a doctor. If you're in need of support, please visit somethingwaswrong.com/resources for a list of nonprofit organizations that can help. Opinions expressed by my guests on the show are their own and do not necessarily represent the views of myself or Broken Cycle Media. Resources and source material are linked in the episode notes. Thank you so much for listening. Nicole Meyer is a mother, educator, and victim survivor of several types of abuse from Australia. Her journey towards justice and healing was a long, arduous one that spanned 15 years and two countries. Amidst it, Nicole was eventually joined by her sisters, who she would find out were victims of her alleged abuser. The highly publicized nature of their legal battle inspired them to participate in the documentary Surviving Malka Lifer, and has propelled Nicole to continue to speak out in Parliament and worldwide. Her mission is to unite and empower survivors, as well as to spread awareness as a means for prevention. The Broken Cycle Media team is so very appreciative of Nicole's time, advocacy, and powerful perspective in these episodes.
She amped up her abuse drastically in those months and leading up to my wedding. In her words, she was preparing me for my wedding night. The following year, going into the fourth year, her abuse continued. I was pregnant enough to have a bump, so I was probably about 4.5 months, and she lay down full length on top of me. That was the defining moment where I understood that I absolutely can never be alone with her in a room again. It doesn't mean the abuse stopped, because it didn't. She still crossed tremendous amount of boundaries, ongoing until the day she left, 2008. Early 2008, my sister overseas disclosed to a social worker who used to live in Melbourne that Malka Lifer had abused her. This social worker called me, and without even thinking, I confirmed, yes, she did, because she did it to me too. Within 3 days, Malka Lifer came to my classroom looking so scared and asking me if I know what's going on. I had been prepared by some people that I shouldn't tell her anything. And then that night, she left the country. Obviously, it came out in the news. People knew I was a victim. And that was it. I was early pregnancy with my second son, and I just continued working. It was one day to the next. There was no warning. There was no difference. And then I had my second son, completely dissociated the entire abuse history, out of my mind, continued working, had my third child. And then early 2011, my youngest sister, the third of us, went to the police with the encouragement of her boyfriend at the time and disclosed the abuse. A couple months later, my next sister made a police statement. And then October 2011 is when I decided that I'm going to walk into a police station, not one in the area. I'm going to drive 20 minutes out and I'm going to give a police statement. To this day, giving the police statement was so traumatizing that I have no memory of giving my police statement at all. The only vision I have is standing outside the police station after the fact and having a paper in front of me signed by me. That's how traumatizing that actually was to speak of what had happened and had just stopped happening in 2008, but had happened for so many years before that. It was also the day I found out I was pregnant with my youngest. So it was a very difficult pregnancy, I would say, emotionally, that followed that level of disclosure. It was the first time I had ever spoken to anyone about anything. And all I could think in the years to follow was, gosh, that was a very mild statement. That was the first time I ever put words to what she had done to think that it was wrong. I called the school and said, I need a week off for emotional, mental reasons without saying what or why. All I knew was, even if I didn't have an awareness of how much I was impacted, was that I couldn't go back to work that week. It was the first time I made a conscious decision that I need to mentally somehow look after myself. And I went back to work the next week. I remember emailing the police constantly because it was supposed to be a quick get the statements, send them to Canberra, and then go pick her up. It was meant to be very uncomplicated, very simple. And it just slowly started. The detective changed at least two or three times. No communication. It was like crickets for years. This is 2012, 2013, 2014. Through the years that she was evading justice before she got arrested, there are allegations that she abused in that time. And then in 2014, I finally left the school that I had been abused in because I started having flashbacks of abuse happening in different areas in the school. That was 10 years working in that school, and I loved each of those 10 years so much. I started in a new school, and then very randomly, 2014, she was arrested. We had no communication from the police. I heard from the media. I called my sisters. They were both traveling overseas, and I said, Michaelife has been arrested. It was such a shock to all of us, and it was like, what's going to happen now? So of course we called the police, had a meeting. We had no idea what was going to unfold. We had no idea that she's going to be arrested and then she's going to be put on bail and then she's never going to see a courtroom again for years. She was bailed and then she started her tricks for the next bunch of years. Every time there's a court hearing so they can start the process of extraditing, she pretended to be mentally unwell. She started checking herself into a psych ward before a court hearing, checking herself back out after. And this is me and my sisters, court hearing after court hearing, speaking to the prosecutors, begging them to do something, to change something, to see through her lies and to make sure she gets back here so we can face justice. It didn't matter how much we tried to speak and plead our case overseas through the phone calls, nothing seemed to be changing. And then we got the worst news. She's so unwell that we're only going to do checkups every 6 months. And if after a certain amount of time, she's just too unwell, they're going to drop the case. And we were like, that can absolutely not happen. So my sister Dusty started a campaign. We had seen a picture of Michaelife floating around someone's socials. She looked perfectly fine and normal in a busy place surrounded by people. She's not that mentally unwell. It doesn't mean mentally unwell people can't do those things. They can, but not the level that she was saying to the courts. Her psychologist was saying she was unable to move. We hopped on a plane in 2017 and began our first campaign trip. We spoke to members of parliament. We went to speak to Rape Crisis Centre. We met with any influential people. We met with journos. We started to spread awareness that this is what's happening and we need her to come back. People listened to us. They heard us. We continued pushing for her to have court hearings. We went back to 2018. We did the same thing again. But by this time, the momentum started rolling and it started to become more well known. There started to be whisperings that there must be something happening that is stopping her from coming back. The psychiatrists must be lying. The psychologists are giving false reports. The prosecution got stronger in proving that something was happening. We met with an incredible person who heard us talking and she's like, I can help you. She decided that she's going to set up a private investigator at her cost into the area where Michaelife lives. And they're going to follow her and just record her and show the courts that she is not mentally unwell because she's shopping, she's going on buses. When that private investigation went to the police saying, this is evidence that Michaelife is faking her mental unwellness, that is what got her arrested the second time. And no way was she bailed ever again. Between 2019, 2018, it came out that the health minister of Israel had been involved in pressuring the psychiatrists and psychologists to write false reports for Michaelife. That blew up the case to absolutely the highest level. It was a huge, huge story that was unfolding. At some point in the years that followed, the health minister was charged. He's not allowed to work in government. And he got a small fine. For us, that felt like a real slap on the wrist. The crux of the whole thing was in March 2020, there were three psychiatrists who had assessed Malkalaifa. I called my husband and I said, I need to be in court for the next few court hearings because every time we are in court, we feel the judge sees us as a victim. We are important to the case. So my husband is amazing. He looked after the kids again. My sisters both couldn't come that time. It was just me. I sat in the courtroom for two full days listening to psychiatrists be grilled and cross-examined within an inch of their life. It was in a language I didn't fully understand, but it was a topic that I obviously was well acquainted with, so I understood some of it. I had one person sitting there with me to help translate some stuff for me. And by the end of it, I think the prosecution felt hope. We had to wait for the judge to come back with a judgment. I was mentally and emotionally wiped. I went back home. Within a couple of weeks, we heard the news that she's fit to be extradited. And that was spread around the world. We had people in Russia and Washington and this news and that news. Like, it was everywhere because this had been a years-long battle of trying to get her back. Then there was the question of when is she going to come back and how is she going to come back? And then COVID started happening and my sisters and I were like, what's going to happen? January 2021, the last plane that came out of Israel before the skies closed was the one with Malkalaifa on it. It was unbelievable. So many people had told us along the years just to give up. She's never going to come back. Because COVID already hit, two detectives from Australia flew to pick her up. They explained to us the foot race they had to bring her back before the skies closed. They got her on the plane. The only reason why we knew is because some random person on the tarmac decided to snap a picture of this woman going up the stairs with her legs and hands in handcuffs. And that went absolutely viral. That is a picture that I look at so often because it signifies something that the world thought was impossible to do, which was to bring Malkalaifa back to Australia. It still is something that blows my mind, seeing that and knowing something we had fought so hard for actually came to fruition.
So that's a 10-year battle to extradite her.
Yes. Altogether, Malkalaifa got extradited on 74 charges. The moment she landed here was absolutely momentous. We also knew from the moment she landed here, we could not talk. It was an ongoing, active case. It was terrifying that she was on the same soil, physically closer to me. Definitely activated that fear response in my body of I felt closer to her. I felt connected to her again. There's maybe that trauma bond, but it was like she used to be this far away thing that could never be held again because she avoided justice and she avoided courts for so long. And suddenly she was there and it felt real. It felt like this possibility can actually happen. We were in touch with a team straight away in the court system in Melbourne to find out what is our next step. In Victoria, and I think it's going to be abolished, there is a process called a committal hearing where a victim is put through cross-examination by the defense lawyer to test the case. After that, the judge decides if the case can go to trial. So we had a committal hearing in 2021 in September. We could not talk to the media going into the courtroom or coming out. They tried to be around on the first day. The guard just kicked them away. And I just was put through 3 days of cross-examinations by a defense lawyer about anything and everything around my statements. I didn't mention before that I gave additional statements in 2019, 2018, 2020, working through therapy and being able to recover a lot of those memories. So those statements were added to my original statements. I was tested on all of that, and then my sisters were as well. And then a couple of weeks later, we were told that it was going to be committed to trial. Malkalaifa was in prison and not going on bail, so there was no fear of her being out in the community, and it was huge. Malkalaifa got 74 charges. The way it works here in Victoria, and I'm not sure around the world, is that a jury cannot get an overloaded indictment, so they will class a bunch of charges together and put them under assault rather than specific counts. So the jury all up got 29 charges. 29 that the prosecution felt would be the amount the jury could handle, which in my mind doesn't make any sense because we are the victims. We went through all those years of abuse. If we had to handle it, the jury should be able to handle hearing really the extent of the abuse that she did. I only received 5 charges out of those 29. It bothered me, but I put aside my bother for the greater good, thinking, well, there's enough charges between all of us. Even though I only got 5, I'll do a good job on those 5. And it was the worst nature. It was of rape, 4 of them, but there was so much more than that. And it didn't give much scope for the jury to understand the full extent of her abuse over so many years with me particularly. Unfortunately, those 5 were limited to a very small part of her offending. And I felt there was so much more of her offending that could have been included in further charges. At that point of time, we started having about 10 to 12 organizations approach us for doing a drama series or a documentary because she's back and there is a story. All of a sudden, everyone wanted a piece of it. My sisters and I, we had done a documentary in 2017-18 with a local TV program, 3 episodes to raise awareness of the story. And we looked at each other and we're like, do we really want to film again? Then we thought about it and we said, if we don't, the story is going to be said without our permission. The narrative will be taken from us. So rather we choose to do it, to have choices on what is presented. And this is all through COVID, we're meeting with different organizations and deciding who we want to work with. Once we chose someone, starting the contract. And for the first time in all our years of all the massive campaign work we did, we actually had to get an entertainment lawyer to sit and look through the contract and make sure that we are being respected and our rights are being respected. It was so odd because people would think we had someone guiding us all along the way. We had done everything ourselves until then. No one had helped us. It was just the 3 of us. Of course, people stepped up, made phone calls, made connections, but all the organizing and all the meetings and all the media we had done had all come from us. We got word in early 2022 that the trial's going to be 2nd of August, 2022. That is my birthday. Great day to start trial. I'm preparing with my therapist. I'm having extra sessions to walk through and talk about the charges. I had to learn how to say body parts. I avoided saying body parts for so long. They were too hard for me to say. We would walk in the park so that I wouldn't be just sitting in a frozen state while learning to say the list of words that I would have to say in court to describe the abuse. All this time, we are also being filmed for the documentary. So we're having cameras follow us. They didn't even use any of that stuff because we didn't have trial then, but we still got filmed and it was still taxing and draining. I couldn't be a good parent when I was investing myself so much into this trial, which was so high stake. It was terrifying. It was big. It was public. It was my sisters and I. No other victims came forward. So all of the evidence weighed upon us. We decided together we're going to move out of home. And our brother stepped up and helped us find a place and pay for a flat near to the courts. We would just move out of home for a couple of weeks and really immerse ourselves into that world. And we did. And then the day before court was meant to start, literally the 1st of August, we got a phone call. The pre-trial arguments are going to take too long and the trial's being pushed off to February 2023. It was devastating. The emotional roller coaster, the needing to go back home and lose money on the place because we had paid in advance, which was awful because they wouldn't give it back no matter what documentation we provided them. It really destabilized us and made those 5 months torturous, counting down the days, waiting for the trial to actually begin. Literally days leading up to the trial, I got a phone call from the prosecution that portions of my statement that I was practicing and rehearsing and getting ready to speak about was redacted. I cannot talk about any abuse that happened from the day I got married onwards and other incidents that were in my statement that they had taken out. It was just awful. They literally sent me a new statement with large portions whited out. Those were the things I was absolutely not allowed to talk about. And if I did, it would be a mistrial. I sent the most emotional filled message to the prosecutor saying, how could you do this to me so soon before trial with no heads up? I don't want to do this trial. And I was their first witness and I was struggling. My wonderful therapist at the time was going on break. And that was the day that I got the phone call in her office 5 minutes before she went on break. I had an incredible backup therapist who was all prepared to work with me through trial. I have text messages that I messaged the prosecutor in February 2023. I said, Michael Life is actually in the courtroom. Is it really true? Because I didn't believe that she wouldn't pull a trick at the last minute to pull the rug out from under our feet again. It was unbelievable to think that it can actually happen. She updated me and said, yes, jury's being impaneled now. Then they had 2 days of opening arguments. Then it was my turn on the stand. Another thing that the prosecution did not prepare us well enough for, and I think many victims might resonate with this, there was 2 days where prosecution and defense both opened the trial. We cannot attend. The news can. It is not closed court. Every single detail of every single charge was tabled and put in the news. I've never seen a sex crimes reported like that before in my life. I don't know why they decided to do that, but it had name of the act, where it happened, the nature of it, and who it happened to, all over the news. Now, we officially are not supposed to be reading any news, and we didn't. But we had no warning until people called us and said, did you know all your charges are in the news? Everyone can see. It was a shock. You're not allowed to read each other's charges and stuff like that. We were very careful not to, and we knew we couldn't, but we read them after the trial. And why didn't the prosecution prepare us that the whole world is going to know our abuse charges from what's supposed to be a closed courtroom the next day? So we all got up in the morning, got dressed, and walked into court holding hands, a show of strength, massive media pack outside the courtroom, can't talk a word to the media. Our brothers came along as well. Our older sister came along as well. A couple of my sister's friends. I personally did not bring any support people for myself. That's just the way that I operate. I didn't need anyone besides my sisters. And we all walked into courtroom really powerfully. This is the day I'm going to reclaim my voice. I'm going to get justice. We met with the team downstairs. We had a social worker assigned to us for the case. She's amazing. Police detective. She's incredible. The prosecutor, the QC, the KC, Queen's Counsel, King's Counsel, like top kind of prosecutor that was going to do our case. He and I walked into the courtroom, and just walking past the back row of chairs, the jury all sitting there, and Malka Leifa sitting there. I had never actually seen her in the flesh since 2008. It was the most visceral felt sense in my body that I'm in the same room, physically so close to a woman who has so much power over me, even in all her years of not being physically close to me. It was terrifying, but it was also empowering that I'm on this side and she's at the back in the dock with two guards next to her. She's behind a screen, so I didn't fully see her. We requested a screen so she's not staring at us the whole time. I sat in the witness box, my hands shaking. It's hard to describe to someone who's never been through court what it's like, but it takes over your entire body, entire mental state. The assistant brought me a cup of water, told me where to sit, had me swear on oath or affirm, and I affirmed. I looked at the jury. I silently counted about 30 people in the room, and that's closed court because you have the clerks and you have the junior barristers and you have the prosecutors and you have the person who's typing and you have the jury and you have the guards and you have the guard at the main door and the detective and the social worker. The judge comes in. Everyone stands, of course, and everyone sits. The courtroom is just so serious and so quiet. The judge is so authoritative. He is so imposing. There is no warmth or humanity or care, even at the professional level. There's just nothing from him. I think Michael Leifa tried to destabilize me a bit in the beginning because she couldn't see me. And so we had to pause in the very beginning and set up a screen for her to watch me through a computer screen behind her screen that's protecting her from watching me so that she could see me giving evidence. So that already destabilized a bit in the morning. But again, it showed her rights over necessarily our rights. I was mentally putting myself back so many years in spaces I had avoided on purpose for so many years to be able to be the most believable witness possible on the witness stand. And the defense lawyer is awful. He is snuffling, he's shuffling, he's sniggering, he's making faces with his junior. Anything to distract while I'm doing my evidence, while the prosecutor is walking me through the years of my abuse, of what he's allowed to speak on and what I'm allowed to answer to. The defense lawyer's junior was a female. It felt so betraying that a female who's listening to another female talk about abuse can be so arrogant and smirking when someone's talking about the most awful times of their life. It just felt betraying. From a female, it felt worse. I don't know why, but it just did. I just spoke and answered. I just did that all the way until lunchtime. There might have been a mid-morning break, and then the evidence continued the whole afternoon, and then I walked out of my first day. I saw my sisters on the lunch break. The film crew was there on the lunch break, and they filmed me before and they filmed after, and I think I was just shell-shocked. It's an experience that is so difficult to explain, what it's like to be in a courtroom, talking the most graphic details of abuse to a room full of strangers, a topic that I already felt so incredibly ashamed and difficult to talk about, but it felt like I was doing the right thing. Once I gave evidence and was cross-examined for a couple of days on the stand, after that, legally, I and my sisters were allowed to be in the courtroom, but we were cautioned and encouraged not to be in the courtroom watching the rest of the proceedings because our facial expressions can be seen by the jury, and it's better not to for our sake. So we ended up getting permission to sit on level one, court was on level four, and watch it live through a live link. There was a couple of hiccups here and there because the defense lawyer jumped up and down, didn't want us watching the courts all together, wanted each of us on a separate link, and try to still, I guess, maintain control of the situation. But in the end, through time, we ended up just being in one room together. I really wanted to be in the courtroom. I wanted to stare her down. I wanted to listen carefully and see her responses, read the jurors' faces, see how all the lawyers were interacting. But unfortunately, we were really encouraged not to do that. So the best option was to listen and watch on a link, still in the courthouse. There weren't an extensive amount of witnesses, but simply myself, my two sisters, each of us giving evidence, and then having days of cross-examination, that alone took a couple weeks. When trial finally finished at about the six-week mark, you have the closing arguments by the defense lawyer, the closing arguments by the prosecution, and then the judge gives his closing statements. He summarizes the whole case, he summarizes prosecution, he summarizes defense, and then he gives jury instructions. When he summarized all of that, there was one point in that whole process where he made a comment that was so invalidating to me specifically. And I was sitting in that room, wrote it down straight away. I have it written down, time, date, exact words in my notes. He basically, in a very small amount of words, said, "I allowed myself to be abused." He was summarizing the defense, but the defense did not say those words. I got validation from the prosecution and the social worker and the police who were all in the courtroom who heard the way he said that. Now, statistically, what the judge's closing statements do is have a very lasting impact on the jury. I will never know if that specific sentence stuck in the jury's mind after hearing my part of the story, what I was allowed to share. It's something that I've sat with. It's been very hard for me. I've had to really work my way through it. What was the hardest part was when trial finally finished at about the six-week mark, the jury deliberated. The waiting period for the jury deliberation is the most excruciating time of the entire trial. The jury deliberation began. Basically, we were told if we are not within 15 minutes of getting to court, the verdict will be delivered without us. So my sisters and I looked at each other and we said, there is no way that we are not hearing the verdict. So we came to court every single day. But this time we weren't listening to anything. So we did one day tour the city. We did a bit of filming. But really, we were so on edge and so nervous. And day one and day two. And there's media every day gathering outside. Even more. Day three. Day four. We go into the first weekend. That was excruciatingly painful to sit through a weekend knowing that we still have more waiting days. Then we start the next week. On day five, I think, the jury had a question and everyone got into such a tizzy. It was like, oh, there's going to be some verdicts given. Everyone ran and the KC, he asked the judge if we can come in, and the judge was like, I'm not waiting. And he said, they're right outside, Your Honor. So we quickly ran into the courtroom and it was just a question. It wasn't a verdict, but everyone had gotten so activated. That question was answered. He gave a jury direction. Jury went back. We went back, but at least we had felt like something was alive again because we were all so anxious waiting. Then it was day six, day seven. Then it was another weekend. My sisters and I looked at each other and we're like, it has to come. And then somehow we all had this feeling that the verdict's coming on Monday. We all did. We all wore the same clothes we wore the very first day of trial. We made that very conscious decision. We're going to walk in with our heads held high. The media outside was intense. Everyone felt it in the air. It was like everyone knew that was the day it was going to happen.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Next week on What Came Next.
I was not hearing absolutely anything anyone said. Everyone left the room and they left my sisters and I alone together. My sisters were literally heartbroken for me. They were collapsing and I couldn't break down. There is no mention of me in the sentencing. It's like I have become invisible in the rest of whatever happens going forward. So that day was as traumatizing for me as the day of the verdict. April 3rd, exactly a year after the verdict, I checked myself into a hotel and I sat and recorded seven parts of my victim impact statement that I could not say in court. And that was the most healing thing I've ever done.
What Came Next is a Broken Cycle Media production, co-produced by Amy B. Chesler and Tiffany Reese. If you'd like to help support What Came Next, you can leave us a positive review, support our sponsors, or follow Broken Cycle Media on Instagram at Broken Cycle Media. Check out the episode notes for sources, resources, and to follow our guests. Thank you again for listening.